Welcome to We Empower, the radio show that inspires you to embrace your potential, resilience, and strength. In these challenging times, we're here to help you unlock your power to overcome obstacles, pursue your dreams, and shape a brighter future. I'm Annabelle Ternes, your host for this empowering hour. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of We Empower. I'm thrilled to have you all with us today. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Let's make today count. In today's episode, where we have a great guest here to introduce, it is Felix Finkbeiner, the founder of Plan for the Planet Foundation. Planted his first tree at 9. Today, he leads a global youth movement, restoring ecosystems, a voice of hope for our planet future. And then later on, I have also an inspiring book for you, which is When Time Stopped, a bestseller book. But let's first kick things off with the song selected by FedEx.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. Yeah, darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Yeah, darling, it feels like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say, it's all right.
Just looking out of the window, I think here just comes the sun. So maybe the song evoked it. And I'm sure that you know the song. But what you maybe don't know is Harrison wrote it in Eric Clapton's garden, literally basking in the first sunshine after a long English winter. And the song mirrors that personal relief, a private moment turned universal. But it ranked among the 500 greatest songs of all time. And has a big cultural impact And I would say it has also a kind of symbol expression because it's written by George Harrison during a difficult period, Beatles tensions, legal battles. The song embodies resilience. A cheerful melody and lyrics about emerging from winter into sunlight became an anthem of optimism. So I really love the song, and thank you so much, Felix, for sorting it out, and welcome here in the show.
Thank you very much, Annabeth.
Felix, at just 9 years old, you had a bold idea to plant 1 million trees to fight the climate crisis. The childhood vision grew into a plan for the planet, a global reforestation initiative that has since mobilized millions of trees and young climate leaders across continents. You stand as a powerful example of how one child's voice can become a movement for millions around the globe. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Felix, if we start with your childhood, do you remember the exact moment you decided to start a kind of movement, to not wait longer to act and just move?
I definitely didn't intend to start something like this, but I do remember the moment when it did start. I was in fourth grade and I was supposed to give a little presentation about the climate crisis in my class. And that weekend, while preparing that presentation, I found out about a woman from Kenya called Wangari Maathai, an incredibly impressive person who started the Greenbelt Movement, a movement of women across Kenya and later all of East Africa, planting trees to address environmental degradation. And she used tree planting not just as a tool to address environmental issues, but also as a tool for women's empowerment. But, 9-year-old Felix, I didn't understand that complexity of her work. I only understood that trees help address the climate crisis and therefore save my favorite animal, the polar bear. And that's why I wanted to plant trees. And that's how it started.
That's great. Wangari Maathai is, of course, a really great role model. But she did some things, I would say, wrong. You have done right, because she always suffered a little bit with her with her idea of making a world a better place. And only after her death, the people really understood what greatness is in her and in her voice and in this what she wanted to drive further. I mean, she did start something great, but I think it could have started and developed much, much greater. You started very early, also involving other kids, other people, really understanding how important it is that a movement needs people to move.
I don't know if that's, I would fully agree there. Obviously, she started with insane headwinds. I mean, she was a woman in Kenya in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, where starting anything like that is obviously much, much harder
That's
than
right.
it was for me or us much later. She was jailed several times as part of her activism, just one such example. And nonetheless, she managed to inspire hundreds of thousands of women. And even though she was disrespected and ignored and blocked for so much of her life, I'm very glad that by the end, about 6 years before she passed away, she received the Nobel Peace Prize, and her wonderful work was really acknowledged and celebrated by the end.
I'm completely agreeing with you. Would you say that nowadays our times are better for initiatives like this to be recognized and with the ability also to grow?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, there are obviously all of these differences, like the comfort and wealth that you are born into when you grow up in Germany versus 1960s, 50s Kenya, that are incredibly different.
But if even if you ignore those major head starts, the internet, the ability to connect with people and to collaborate internationally, obviously makes any sort of such work a lot easier today than it was decades ago.
Absolutely, I think so too. I mean, from very beginning, you went very international, right? But what did your parents say when you told them about your idea when you were 9 years old?
I was incredibly lucky that when I had this crazy idea that kids should plant 1 million trees in each country of the world, everyone around me was immediately incredibly supportive, at least as I perceived it. My parents, amongst them, my teacher, my head of school a little later, and so on. And I could definitely imagine a context, or if a kid came to me today with an idea like that, it's very easy to react differently, to react dismissively. And I'm very grateful that that's not what happened. When I first told my teacher about this idea, she asked me questions. So, how are you going to go about this? What's the first step? And guided me to presenting my idea to the student councils, and then helped me set up a meeting with our head of school to present the idea there. So my teacher really helped me get from this point of having an idea to the first steps there, and I'm still very grateful that she did that.
That's great that when teachers are so supportive and understanding that they have to support a seed and have to support planting ideas, even if they have no clue about it. When I came to Monaco and I saw first, I remember that I saw this poster where you as a small kid are standing in front of VIPs, putting them the hand on the mouth. I thought, yes, the greatest ideas are the simple ideas, right? Where you just said, stop talking, start planting. Can you remember or share with us the story of this first party, I think it was, where you went there and just put your hand to the mouth of the VIPs?
Yeah, this is so a couple of years into us starting with our tree planting work, we realized to be able to spread this message and to get more and more kids around the world involved in planting trees and obviously spread the message of the importance of fighting the climate crisis, we needed an easy way to get attention. And that was our campaign, Stop Talking, Start Planting. Basically, what we would do whenever we found a celebrity, anywhere really, we would ask them, respectfully, naturally, if we could take a photo with them, like that. And I'd always have an example, of one of these photos in my pocket of one other celebrity we'd already done it with. So it gave the whole thing a little bit of credibility because you'd speak to a celebrity and within a few seconds you need to convince them that they're not going to embarrass themselves allowing that kid to take that strange photo. But yeah, we'd find the celebrity, cover their mouth, and say stop talking, start planting, and that worked incredibly well. I mean, one time as at an event with the now King of Spain, then still Prince of Spain, and we took that photo the day after it was on all the cover pages of the Spanish newspapers, and that helped launch our work in Spain. And we had many similar successes in other places with people like the Prince of Monaco, Giselle Bündchen, and many others. There's maybe the best one was with Harrison Ford. I might have been around 12 years old or something when that happened. We were at this conference, and we saw this man walk through the courtyard with this big following of people. And I was sitting there with another young ambassador, also roughly my age, ambassador of Plant for the Planet. And she said, "I don't know who that guy is, but I think he's important." So we go up to him. We ask him to take the photo. He agrees. We take the photo, and then I asked one of the photographers standing around him who that was. He told me Harrison Ford. I did not know that name, but obviously looked him up later on, and that photo really helped spread our message internationally.
Wow, that's great. Were these the times where you realized that your idea was becoming bigger than you?
That for sure, but there were also many such similar moments much earlier on. About 6, 7 months after we planted our first tree, we'd fo found a slightly older student who created a very simple website for us. And the website was basically just a ranking of local schools of who had planted the most trees. And lots of schools wanted to join and get to the top of the leaderboard. And of course, there were lots of schools there that I never heard of in towns I'd never heard of. So seeing these people register their planted trees on our website, Googling the names of these schools afterwards was really inspiring and motivating.
I can imagine. How did you feel speaking in front of the United Nations? I think you must have been also 12, 13.
Yeah, I think it was around 13 at the time. I was obviously incredibly nervous. I just remember the minutes before the speech started, wishing I was at home at school at that time. But I've always found that the first few minutes of such a like of a big speech are always the most nerve-wracking. So what I like to do is practice those first few minutes of any speech. 5 times more than the rest of it, because I know that once I've dealt with those first 2 minutes of nervousness, I calm down and the rest is easy.
That's great. I mean, who was the first stranger to join your mission, and how did that change things for you?
That's a good question. I was probably my head of school back then. I'd never met her before until a couple of days into this project, when my teacher suggested that, to plant a tree on a school ground, I need to talk to the head of school. So together we set up a meeting with the head of school. I explained to her about the polar bears and why trees were so important, and that therefore we needed to plant a tree at our school. And that's what we then did a couple of weeks later, and she was obviously lovely about it, and like everyone else at the time, very supportive and made it possible.
That's great. And what did your schoolmates think of your idea in the beginning?
I don't remember exactly, but there were definitely a bunch that were quite enthusiastic. Actually, one of the people that went to school with me back then and helped plant that first tree is now also on the board of our Plant for the Planet Foundation in Spain,
Oh, wow.
Victoria Hohenlohe, and helps us spread the message there. It's really wonderful that people have been part of this journey for so long.
Wow, that's a great, great symbol, not only for that people followed you, that people have understood it, but also that you created a movement which hit the people by heart and which is easy to be understood, right? If you have such a success. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing more from you. So after the commercials, which will take approximately 2, 3 minutes, we are back here. So stay tuned. And I'm looking forward to hearing more from you.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We move on with a talk with Felix, Felix Singbeiner, who has planted his first tree at 9, and today he leads a global youth movement restoring ecosystems, a voice of hope for our planet's future. Thank you for being here, Felix. We talked in the first part already about the start of your movement. And I mean, it sounds for me that you were from the beginning super enthusiastic. Things were going right, and you met great people. Was there one moment or ever a moment where you felt like giving up?
Many moments, of course. I mean, we've been doing this for 18 years now, and in 18 such years, there are many harder moments, of course. One quite early one I remember was around 2012. By then, we'd obviously been doing this work for about 5 years and had matured a bit. It's going great. But we were looking for a way to really bring our work to the next level, to really scale up the number of trees that were being planted, because we obviously realized how much forest was being lost around the world. And then we got a very interesting request. We were invited, or I was invited, to speak at this big conference of the international chocolate industry with many of the CEOs of the big chocolate companies in attendance. And we thought that this was going to be a fantastic opportunity to really fund large-scale forest restoration. The idea was that for all the companies in the audience, the CEOs should promise that for every ton of chocolate they produced, they would donate €1 to plant a tree. And we thought that was a fantastic idea. We prepared the campaign, lots of work around it, months of effort went into this. And then we made the big announcement, and not a single company wanted to participate. Which, you know, if that happened today, might not shock me as much, but 13-year-old me was incredibly disappointed.
I can imagine.
But then something really wonderful happened. One of our other young ambassadors jokingly said, let's make our own chocolate. And a lot of us loved that idea. And there was no one in the room that pointed out some obvious flaws with the plan, like that we have no knowledge of the chocolate industry or how any of that would work. But there were a bunch of lucky coincidences that really helped us along the way. And about 7 months later, the first bars of our chocolate, the chain chocolate, was in stores in Germany. And since then, we've learned a lot about the chocolate industry, gotten better and better selling chocolate. And through the sale of chocolate alone, we've planted roughly 10 million trees now since the beginning of the project back then. That was one of the low points that then led to a big success, but it was only one of many low points, of course, over the years.
But that's a great story, even that an ambassador said and gave the idea. And I know some of your ambassadors, and it's so great seeing these people being so engaged and seeing you as a role model. What story from a young ambassador of Plant for the Planet has touched your heart the most?
There's so many ambassadors that they participate at a Plant for the Planet Academy. They head out. Sometimes we hear from them. Sometimes we don't hear from them for a while. And we then hear about their fantastic work through the press often, and see the great things they've done. Mm-hmm. One
One small example right from the beginning comes to mind after one of our first academies. Academies are one-day workshops we organize where kids learn about the climate crisis and make plans what they want to do, and then at the end they become our ambassadors. And after one such, I think the very first academy actually, we got a letter a couple of days later from one of the young ambassadors to inform us that she started collecting money for trees on the train ride back from the academy, and she had like a 3-hour train ride, and she collected I think 100 euros or something. So she was writing to ask what to do with that money so it could be go to best use, and that was really fantastic. That same day she jumped right into action. Another example, one of our longtime ambassadors has for the past few years worked really hard to push a major boulder up a hill, metaphorically. She collaborated with young people from small island nations with a specific vision that the International Court of Justice, the ICJ in The Hague, should publish an advisory opinion that makes state is clear that governments around the world have a responsibility and a duty to prevent the climate crisis. And what they found out is that one of the easiest ways to get the court to publish an advisory opinion is that the UN General Assembly hold a vote requesting one such advisory opinion. So these were a group of young people, 18, 19, 20 year olds, some slightly older, mostly from small island states in the Pacific, that at first convinced some of their governments, especially the government of Tuvalu. And the government of Tuvalu then, in the Committee of Small Island Nations, convinced a bunch of the other small island nations to make this a shared project. They managed to then gain majority support and get that vote at the UN General Assembly. And then about 18 months ago, the International Court of Justice took on this topic. They had their oral hearings a couple of months ago. And now we've got a couple more months to wait until their advisory opinion is published. And hopefully, obviously, we don't yet know what they'll say, but we expect that this will be a clear statement calling on states that they need to address the climate crisis. That won't single-handedly obviously get states that hadn't previously worked on addressing the climate crisis to suddenly do so. But, of course, this then is a basis from which many national courts can derive judgments. And all of this big change, his consequence is still a little hard to grasp now, was kicked off by a group of young people, especially from small island states, one of them a member of Plan for the Planet. And that's really impressive to see what this type of perseverance over many years yield.
I can imagine. And I mean, you said there were so many situations which were hard. There were also so many great situations which were really amazing for you. And I mean, I like that you are still also planting trees on your own. Has there been a planning moment which was the most meaningful to you, and why?
As you know, my big hero is and was Vangai Maathai, and I was incredibly lucky to get to meet her very briefly.
Wow!
Few months before she passed away.
Wow, that's a great gift.
But my hope was always to plant a tree together with her. We had we'd planned that once we achieved our initial goal of 1 million trees, we would travel to visit her in Kenya
and tell her about it.
Wow.
Obviously, that was no longer possible at that time, but I did then get to travel to Kenya and plant a tree together with her daughter, Manjira
Wow.
Matai, who is a wonderful person in her own right that I've now known for a very long time. And I very fondly remember planting that tree near where Wangari Maathai grew up.
Wow, this is really touching that you did this in memorial, and also that you met her, and that you can, yeah, move on taking that where she started, as she started something really, really substantial. And if you look at climate leadership today, and I had a couple of days ago, I had this green, there was this Green Tech Festival where we spoke about diversity, biodiversity, carbon footprint. What does climate leadership mean to you today? And what do we have to do, maybe also differently to 10 years ago? What is necessary now to make this happen? And what is important more than ever?
I think those early years for us at Plants the Planet, thinking 18, 15 years ago, we were at a time when, in general, our society wasn't taking the climate crisis anywhere near seriously enough. And there's still many people that don't, but in general, we've definitely learned to a certain extent how serious this issue is to a point where it has maybe tipped into the other direction for some people, especially young people who have lost all hope that this problem is solvable and lost hope for the future. And so I think it's now our responsibility to not just warn about this serious challenge, but to also point out all the progress that we have made in the last few years and point out the reasons why our society isn't doomed, right? How why we're not facing a certain collapse, etc. And give young people hope, not only because they deserve it and that's an awful way to live, but also because it's genuinely true that this is still a solvable problem, and because when people lose hope, they also stop acting and doing something to addressing this challenge. We're much more likely to mobilize people to work to solving this problem if they see hope and have hope.
Yeah, absolutely right. And on the other hand, I really like how you deal with the information, and also that you see that you mention the dark sides, but that you keep the hope. And I completely agree with you. It is so important. And also what you say about the people's ignorance, it is unbelievable from my point of view how many people are ignorant against us. I sometimes think it's maybe fear. I sometimes think that's being far away from reality, or just sitting in their own system, and think that with the three monkeys symbol, that things will just move. They just can behave as they have behaved so far, and things will move to the better after a while. And it's just a kind of time they have to shut on their eyes, their ears, and their mouth, and then it's getting over. And I love how you react on that. You've planted millions of trees. But what's the story behind one that particularly matters to you? So what are
I
your
think
next steps?
the first one is definitely still the one that matters to me most. I'm really happy that we planted it right at the entrance of my school back then. So for the next 8 years of going to school, I would walk past it every morning. And I'm still happy that it's still alive, still growing, and will hopefully be there for a very long time.
That's great. I mean, we talked about also these people which still haven't got it. What do you think? What do the people get wrong about reforestation, or what is wrong in their heads? Where are wrong myths maybe we have to change?
I think one thing people are, or that most people unfortunately don't know, is that we've made a lot of progress in recent decades when it comes to forest conservation. I think most people expect that right now we had peak global deforestation that has never been as bad as now in terms of forest loss. It's very important. That's not the case. In fact, that was in the 1980s. At that time, we destroyed about 30 billion trees. We lost about 30 billion trees every year. Since then, that's gone back quite considerably, and we currently lose on average about 10 billion trees every year. Still massive. To give you a sense of, all of Germany has about 8 billion trees. So every year we lose more tree cover than all of the trees in Germany. But still, it's only a third as bad as it used to be. Now that doesn't mean that that we're done. It shows we still have a long way to go, but it shows that this problem of ending deforestation is possible.
And I know that, I mean, people which are ignorant sometimes also act with fighting against, right? Or criticizing without having no idea about how do you deal with critics, or people who doubt your work or who try to attack your work?
I think that brings us back to that hope element. That doesn't work for everyone, but we see a lot of people that doubt this work is or doubt the climate crisis in general, is because not believing the problem exists is obviously very, very convenient, right? If you don't think the problem exists, you don't have to do something about it. But showing that there are effective ways for us to solve the problem, I think, can be a bridge for many to acknowledge the problem in the first place.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you have a really tough, tough day often, right? You are traveling a lot, you're talking to a lot of people, you are in the middle of the hall, you are an idea giver, you are an innovator. Do you want to share a few hacks or rituals over the day which keeps you grounded and so motivated and so optimistic?
I don't know if I have particularly good answers to that, but what helps me most is exercising, is going for a run, going for a swim. That helps me particularly when I'm stressed or exhausted and need new energy.
I think that sounds good because we all need small things which keeps us fresh and which keeps us positive. Do you want to share at the end what one unexpected lesson nature has taught you?
What I find most inspiring is the symbiosis between many plant and animal species out there in the world. One particular one that I've seen a lot, especially in our restoration work in Mexico, is one, the acacia species. And what the species does is it grows these long thorns on its branches. And these thorns are about 10 times as big as the rose thorns. And these thorns are hollow. So they're hollow for a very specific reason, because they provide a home for ants that then live, a very specific species of ants that live in these thorns. And at the base of the thorns, the plant provides nectar, sugars to the ants, right? So the plant provides this wonderful habitable home for the ants, including food. But why would it do that? Well, because the ants then help protect the plant. When a herbivore comes to eat that plant, and the ants feel the shaking, they come out and they bite the herbivores, which makes it obviously a very unappealing tree for any cattle or other species to eat. And it's very effective. These plants are incredibly successful at continuing to exist and fight herbivores. And obviously, the symbiosis works wonderfully well for both the ants and the plants.
That's a very, very great sample. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, Felix. And I hope that many listeners are getting now the idea that it might be interesting for them to support Plant for the Planet in its mission, that they understood how important it is to plant trees and to stop reforestation. Thank you so much, Felix, to be with us. I really enjoyed every second here of our talk with you. And I look forward to our ongoing exchange and the impact we will continue to make together world a better place. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Annabeth.
So we move on after 2 minutes commercial with next and with an inspiring book. It could be a life changer for you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Is this the year you're going to sort out your health goals? Never heard of frequency medicine, but willing to give it a try? Curious to discover there is a way to click your way to optimal health? At BioHealthScan, we found a way for you to recover your lost good health faster than conventional methods, in a safe and pain-free way. Join in with the rest of us and try our 21-day challenge for optimal health. Do it yourself. Save ourselves today. Find your way to biohealth-scan.com/21-day-challenge. Or, for a whopping 20% discount, click on the BioHealthScan 21-Day Challenge DIY SOS banner on the UK Health Radio homepage now. BioHealthScan, paving the way to manage your health a better way.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Now let's move on to the introduction of an inspiring book that can be a life changer. And it's Today, When Time Stopped. It's a bestseller book. And I want to start reviewing this book with a bit personal note. Some stories are not just told, they're unearthed like fragile bones from the earth, demanding to be remembered. Ariana Neumann's When Time Stopped is one such story. A haunting, luminous memoir that pieces together her father's hidden Holocaust past. With the tenderness of a daughter and the precision of a detective, Neumann unravels the life of a man who survived by vanishing into shadows, his pain locked away in silence. This book is not just history, it is a love letter to memory, a reckoning with inherited trauma and a testament to how the past never truly dies. You will feel his fear in the rustle of forgotten papers, his grief in the gaps between his rare words and his resilience in the life he built after. By the end, you will clutch the book to your chest, heartbroken yet grateful, for stories like these are how we keep the lost alive. Ariana Neumann, born 1971, grew up in Venezuela, the daughter of a wealthy industrialist, Hans Neumann, a man who seemed to have no past. She later moved to the US and the UK, working as a journalist and researcher. Her father's mysterious nightmares and a single box of documents sparked her decades-long quest to uncover his secrets. Fluent in multiple languages, Newman combined her archives and combed archives across Europe, interviewed survivors, and even retraced her father's death through Prague's Jewish quarter. What began as curiosity became an obsession to give voice to the ghost her father could not. When Hans Neumann died, he left behind a fragmented identity. A Czech Jew who had escaped Auschwitz by assuming a dead man's name. Ariana knew only fragments, his flight to Venezuela, his success, his silence. The discovery of his pre-war documents revealed a life erased by war. She wrote, when time stopped to reconstruct her story, to honor the family murdered in the camps, and to confront the weight of survival, this book is her act of defense against oblivion. It is a daughter's quest to uncover her father's Holocaust. Survival reveals a tapestry of loss, love, and the unbearable cost of forgetting. Reading the book, I would like to give you some tips from the book I take away. First, silence speaks louder than words. Trauma often hides in what is unsaid. Identity is fragile. A name, a paper, a lie could mean life or death. Memory is rebellion. Forgetting is the enemy of history. Survivors carry invisible wounds. Even in safety, the past never leaves. Love outlives war. Hans rebuilt a family, but grief lingered in his smiles. The Holocaust wasn't just numbers. It was stolen futures, like Ariana's unknown cousins. We must be keepers of stories. When survivors are gone, the truth must not fade. So Neumann's memoir is a masterpiece of historical detective work and emotional depth. Through letters, archives, and interviews, she constructs her father's escape from Prague, his years in hiding as a Catholic factory worker, and the family he lost. The book forces us to ask, how do we live with what we survive? And I would like to give you five quotes from the book before I start reading. He had taught himself to forget. I needed to remember for him. The dead are not gone if we refuse to let them be silent. War does not end when the guns stop. It echoes in the next generation. I realized then that my father's smiles were not absences of sorrow, but victories over it. We think time moves forward. But for survivors, it spirals back to the past, always back to the past, always back to the past. When Time Stopped is more than a memoir, it's a monument. Read it and carry its story forward. And now I would like to read a bit from the book, where it's hard to figure out what is really the best to take out. But I will start with the front. Things are not as easy to understand or express as we're mostly led to believe. Most of what happens cannot be put into words and takes place in a realm which no word has ever entered. There's a question mark, almost lost in a sea of names on the walls of an old synagogue in Prague. Visitors hush children as they pass through each chamber of the Pinker's Memorial. It is hard not to be overwhelmed by the dizzying display of black and red letters. They memorialize 77,297 individuals. Each was a resident of the Czech districts of Bohemia and Moravia during the war. All were victims of the Nazis. Next to every name is stenciled the date of birth, and next to each date of birth neatly sits a date of death. One entry bears the name of my father, Hanno Stanislav Neumann, born on February 9, 1921. It is different. Unlike the others on that wall, it has no date of death. Instead, carefully calligraphed, there is an incongruous and bold black question mark. I visited the memorial in 1997 as a tourist. unaware of any link with the synagogue. Scanning across the top wall to my right, I descended the steps into the first chamber. I was astonished to see my father's name. He was then very much alive, settled and working in Caracas, and yet the bold question mark was there, both jarring and oddly episode. This was the first time I had seen the query on the wall, but questions about my father had emerged long before. My quest for answers started when I was just a little girl, living across an ocean and a sea in a very different world. The questions began with a photograph. It started with a picture that was kept hidden, but was then found. A memento left behind by accident or on purpose, perhaps subconsciously, that engendered doubt. An image that was out of sorts with reality. As I saw it, it forcing the present into an unfamiliar focus. It prompted questions. It demanded answers of the past. My childhood memories hum with the songs of tropiales, crickets, and frogs. My recollections are cradled by tranquil breezes. They sway to the rhythm of tall palm trees and lit by the reds and orange of bird of paradise. Yet in all their warmth, color, and chaos, they're punctuated by the crisp metal rotors, wheels, pivots, and mainsprings of mechanical watches, of beautifully intricate movements with complications. Among enormous sculptures, my mother receives verses from Ruben Dario and Andres Eloy Blanco, and my father dances as he sings Yellow Submarine. Most of my early memories, there are people moving around the open rooms, terraces, and gardens. Politicians, diplomats, industrialists, writers, filmmakers, ballet dancers, gesticulating, chatting, laughing, sitting, or standing, invariably surrounding my parents. There is a noise of success, the prill of happiness, but in some of the memories, the hubbub fades and there is just enough silence to hear the watches tick, click, whir, and chime. Embedded in my memory is the image of a particular watch. It is in a round silver pocket match watch, perfectly polished, lying face down, with its cover off and the gold insides visible. It is an odd piece, different from the others in my father's collection. The watch has four cases. It is rendered in easily tarnished silver. Most of the others are gold and ornately decorated with precious stones. It is large and heavy. The first case, it's delicate, with a braided burgundy cord attaching a key. It has a thick relief motif that would perhaps be more familiar if it were carved in wood. Press a button on the side and the first case pops open to reveal a much finer silver face surrounded by tortoise shell and silver screws. You can see the dial, the curved gold hands, and the face of light and darkened silver ringed with symbols for numbers. The letters in the center spell the maker's name. Inside the second cover is an aged piece of paper trimmed to fit roundly inside the back of the case. A beautiful black script, it reads, Thomas Devers, London, England, made in 1732 in the old watch street shop for export trade India. Inside this is a smaller, plain polished silver case. Within this third unremarkable metal shelf sits another polished silver case that houses the device itself. Eyes are drawn to the beauty of the hands and face, and without the outer cases, the watch now seems rather small and delicate, fragile even. As you lift the glass and inspect the piece closely, additional things are revealed within. And if you examine the face at the 6 o'clock mark, there is a tiny, almost invisible lever. If you move the lever lightly, being careful not to damage the enamel, toward the center, the back of this case clicks open, disclosing a magnificent movement with ornate wheels of interwoven filigree that resemble flowers and feathers of silver and gold. Most people never look at the movement. They rarely open the mechanism to understand what is behind the meticulous timekeeping. For the majority, observing the dial and knowing that the watch functions within a beautiful case is marvel enough. Yet when you examine this peculiar mechanism, you will find it not functioning. The thin silver thread that forms the spring is torn, and the watch cannot keep time. When my memories pan back from the watch, my father is hunched over, his back cocooned by a wide chair. He's wearing a plastic, black plastic visor with two rectangular magnifying lenses in front of his eyes. His thick white hair is tousled around the adjustable band. He's unaware of the world outside, oblivious to me, as I tilt my head through the crack of the door and stare at him. He sits at a purpose-built wooden table, his slim fingers grasping pointed tweezers. He's trying to tease out a thin silver thread from a part of the watch that looks to me like a spool made of gold. He's moving very gently, with absolute precision and fathomless patience. If his fingers were not playing over the watch, just a millimeter here and there, his stillness would suggest that time had stopped. He's trying to repair the mechanism. He needs his watches to be accurate to the second. It seems a necessity rather than a want. He keeps most of them in his bedroom, some on stands in a Louis XV vitrine, some carefully laid in the drawers of a 19th century tulip wood chest that have been specially lined with thick Burgundy velvet. He opens and checks a few at least once a week. The winding mechanisms, the springs, the levers, the chimes. If they need to be regulated, he will take them to his workshop. The long, windless room in my memory, the one of a long corridor by the kitchen, the room that is narrow and resembles the carriage of a train, the room that unfailingly remains locked, its key kept in my father's pocket, attached to a gold chain clipped to a belt loop in his trousers. There he will sit at the table, and he will open which his minuscule tools are arranged. He would soon don one of the black magnifying visors that hang on hooks aligned on the wall. Depending on the watch, he would push a lever or pry the case open and examine the movement. Yes, the latter consists of tiny pellets, a lever, and two feather weights. And I would like to read further because this book is really a monument. But we have heard today so much about, when time stopped and what we want to do to just moving to the future. We heard about past and we heard about how much past can give us hope for the future. We heard a lot about how important it is to never stop following your vision and to never stop holding your dreams. And I hope that you have taken something away for yourself or that it has perhaps piqued your curiosity and interest enough to want to read the book or even go further. Maybe you also want to plant a tree. And if you would like to do something to share here, it would be great if you do so. So that wraps up our episode of We Empower, the weekly radio show dedicated to celebrating the strength, resilience, and limitless potential of women around the globe and men. Join us again next week as we continue on this empowering journey, sharing with stories of triumph, upliftment, and empowerment. Don't hesitate to get involved. Your voice is valued. And together, we can make a difference. Thank you for being part of our community. And until next time, keep shining and empowering others and take care of a world worth living in and what you would like to do for the planet to have a better place for you and for the next generation. And don't forget, if we collaborate, we can do much more. Together, we rise.